Accession number 9145, rule number 6.
Mr. Shobridge, tape 6. Yes, you were saying that that's an assumption of yours, that they went into...
Purely an assumption. One can only make a guess of... I wouldn't like to say it was authentic. The only thing that I do know is that we had, as I say, kick out 700. And they were lucky in as much as that they got away with uniform instead of their old clothes.
Were they very poor, the peasants?
Oh, extremely so. Yes. And it didn't matter in those days how poor they were if they only had a couple of fowls. They had to sacrifice one for the church. They had to give one to the church. If they didn't, they couldn't be blessed. And that was one of the things that they were always concerned about. But the sheer hypocrisy of the whole thing used to annoy all of us. And when we went to church, and the priest would come out flicking the water and blessing the congregation, and sitting quite close to me, standing rather, because there was no seats, I said, and right in front of us was an officer, and he turned around. He said, if he flicks me with that bee cold water, he said, oh, belt him one or something like that. And the officer said, but he was laughing all over his face.
Did you ever see Kolchak or any of the other white generals?
No, I can't say that we did.
Did you see their armies ever?
No. I believe they were based on an island somewhere. I really don't know. But we never came in contact with them. Maybe the generals must have been in contact with him.
How about refugees? You know, because after all, we're now talking about 1919. Were there many Russian people coming eastwards?
If you mean, were they travelling down in flocks, I can honestly say no, because we didn't see them. But remember, this was in the very early days of the revolution. They really hadn't got to... people like Lenin and what have you...
Trotsky
weren't in power at that time. It was Kerensky. And he was obviously far too moderate for Lenin and Trotsky, that they took over and disposed of him. But as regards everything else, life seemed to be fairly placid. We didn't see anything untoward. For instance, when we were... The summer when we were in Ekaterinburg, we held a regatta on the lake there.
Yes, I was going to ask you now about Ekaterinburg, because I believe you were there in 1919,
That's right.
So, did you know anything about the Tsar's family and what had happened to them in that area, in Ekaterinburg, actually?
Only that we knew the room in which they were slaughtered.
Did you see
house.
The building?
Pardon?
You saw the building, did you?
Yes.
And the room?
Only through the window. You could see the walls were spattered with bullet holes. And across the road was his summer palace, a huge place. And we used to hold band concerts in there.
Could I ask you a little more about the house? Because this is very interesting. The house where they were actually shot.
Yeah.
What sort of house was it? Was it a fairly big place?
Yes, it was... It was a very large house. It was two stories. There was the basement, the ground floor, and the first floor, and I believe attics. So in point of fact, you could say it was a three-storied house, couldn't you, with the basement below. And it was a splendidly built house, but by no means comparable with the palace next to it on the other side of the road. Because the roads there, when I say the roads, I mean the main roads, was wide enough for troops to march down 20 abreast, plus the pavements. But the sanitation was very crude.
Yeah. Could I keep to the house where the Tsar's family were murdered?
Yes.
Was it guarded? Did it have a wall or a fence?
Oh no. Oh no. The only the only place it was guarded was his winter palace, and there was not in our time but there was either side of the huge gates. Sentry boxes, well, they'd been removed, but we had been informed that there was a sentry box either side and sentries outside when the Tsar and his family was in residence there.
And could you now tell me, describe this little room, what you could see when you looked through the window, if you could remember as much as possible?
Well, all that you, when you looked through the window from where we were, I'll say on the east side of the house, we looked down into the basement room. The door was away to the left, and it was fairly bare when we saw it, and all that we could see were the bullet holes around the walls.
Were there many of them?
Oh yes, quite a lot, really. As a matter of fact, I would say they seem to have taken great pleasure in firing off as much as they could.
Was it accepted that that was the room where they had all died?
Yes.
And who would have, who would have told you that?
Well, now that's rather an awkward question. You see, we simply had to accept it that it had been passed on, we say, more or less by hearsay. That I wouldn't like to swear that such was the case, but the evidence, as shown up by the room itself, one accepts that that's the place where the slaughter took place.
While you were there, was it ever sort of hinted that there might have been some other explanation, that perhaps they weren't murdered there?
No, none whatsoever.
Most people would have accepted that, would they? There were no sort of searchings in the woods nearby or anything for...
Oh, no, no. There was one incident while we were at Ekaterinburg, and that was we picked up two replacements. Now, where did we pick them up? Well, they joined us at Vladivostok. They came as a replacement Where from at the moment, I've forgotten. But when they joined us, they were a very suspicious couple, because talking to a fellow named Himmelspring, he was a Jewish chappie, one of the nicest fellows you could wish to meet, and generous to a fault. He was sleeping one side of them, and I was sleeping the other. And he was talking about a book they were both reading. And I thought, well, that's rather curious. But my curiosity was somewhat satisfied later when I was called into the office and they said, this new replacement we've got in, you spoke to me, if we had quite a long chat last night. Why, what were they talking about? And I mentioned about this book. So they said, did they have it? I said, well, he told me he got it in his kit bag. And it was obviously a strong communist book, some description. I've forgotten the name anyway. And they said, oh, well, when they go out, could you follow at a discreet distance without them suspecting that you were following them? I said, well, I said, two or three of us could go to the lake as if we're going bathing. Oh, it's a good idea. So off we went. And when these two left, we give them about 5 minutes start, and they were walking on the pavement, as we noticed, and we were in the middle of the road, just smoking and chatting and completely ignoring them, until they came to a cafe. And the name of the cafe was Schwartz. And they just walked in as if they were expected. And because I must have been the proprietor out on the doorstep looking out for them or waiting for them, and shook hands and come right in. And as we were going along, he gave us quite a suspicious look. But we just walked on as if we didn't notice him, and out to a lake. It turned out eventually that these two were two spies planted. But I don't think they got very far.
Who would they have been working for then, do you think?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because as a matter of fact, they were arrested one night in the barracks about midnight. And with us, who was, I would say, he must have been a student of Russia, because he could speak fluent Russian, and had a most unusual name, was Lieutenant Turkeytine. That he was an extremely nice fellow. And anyway, we saw these two chaps get up at midnight, and we never saw them again.
Can you remember their names?
No, I'm afraid I can't. But
they were in your battalion, were they?
Yes, they joined us. I'm trying to think where they really joined us. It must have been when we got to... No.
Not to worry.
It must have been when we got to Omsk.
Because Ekaterinburg is sort of further west, I think, northwest of Omsk, isn't it? So you would have been really quite close to the Red Forces then, would you not, in Ekaterinburg?
Well, we were right on the edge of the Ural Mountains.
That's right, yes.
And there was all, don't forget, there was British troops also at Murmansk.
That's right, yes.
Right up on the north coast. That, yes, I think the first contact we had with these two was must have been at Omsk. Because they came with us to Ekaterinburg, and it was from Ekaterinburg that we followed them to this. Well, we didn't follow them actually in so far, and yet in another sense we did. To this German restaurant. So whether they were working on behalf of the Germans, it was very difficult to say. I wouldn't like to make a definite statement to that effect.
But there was definitely something suspicious.
Oh, yes.
Which was proved against them. Yes. But in Ekaterinburg, during the course of 1919, what was your task there? Were you doing anything there that you weren't doing in Omsk?
Oh, no. No, as a matter of fact, it was more like a holiday period, really, because we used to go rowing and swimming in the lake. We did have one unfortunate accident there. The lake I'm referring to was more or less part of Ekaterinburg. But there was another lake way out past where these two chaps went into Schwartz's cafe. And one of our lads, normally was a good swimmer, he dived in and was swimming, and all of a sudden he disappeared. And we shouted. And several chaps was already in the lake. I wasn't, my friend wasn't. And he didn't show up for, you know, usually they come up for the third time or go down for the third time. But he just went down the once. And somebody said, better fetch the doctor. Well, we'd got no transfer there. Well, I ran all the way back to barracks, which was a good mile and a half. And I think fear of not being able to get help to him quick enough, I hardly felt my feet touch the ground. But I know by the time I got in the barracks, I just about flaked out, and I was able to explain what had happened. And the doctor and another officer got the car out, and away they raced. And then they left me behind. But anyway... they never recovered his body. They could only assume that he got caught in a whirlpool. Because it was such a funny thing for him to suddenly disappear without a cry as he was swimming. And either he struck a patch of ice-cold water, the only thing we can think of, and... It might have struck his heart. Could have had a heart attack and just sank like a stone.
What was the population of Ekaterinburg during the period you were there? Were there many refugees from other areas of Russia?
No, not that we could see.
And what sort of atmosphere was it in 1919?
Very calm.
Would you have known there was a sort of civil war situation?
No. You wouldn't have thought so.
How about food? The availability of food for the population?
Now, that would be very difficult to describe. But the only thing was, in the restaurant that we went to after our regatta, it was very well patronized inside, and there seemed to be no shortage of food. As I say, there was... The only particular shortage was in sweetstuffs. Chocolate, we'll say, was unsweetened. Jam was unsweetened. You just had the flavour of the fruit, whatever it was made of.
You mentioned how in Omsk you went to this house of the ladies and spoke English to them.
Oh,
were
yeah.
you entertained in a similar fashion in Ekaterinburg by any Russians?
No, we never had an opportunity there.
Did you meet many Russian people?
No. Not socially in any way. We had one very amusing episode there that nearly caused trouble, and you'll have the photograph there. The place where we were billeted was immediately opposite the fire station. Now their fire engines there were worked by hand, and it would be a huge barrel, the size, almost the size of this room, but barrel shaped, you see, and worked by hand pumps like that. We had in our hall, stacked either side of the fireplace, it was a daft place to put them, boxes of ammunition. Well, we had an extra big fire in there, and all of a sudden some of the ammunition caught fire and was exploding. Well, it dashed over for the fire brigade, and the amusing part of it was, out comes the fire brigade, belts hell for leather up the road, turns round, come back down our side of the road, outside a place, and started to unload the hose pumping. Well, normally one would have expected them to have thrown the hose across the grass verge that was separating the road, like, well, it wasn't very wide, it was like a garden going the length of the road. You'd have thought they would have thrown the hose over the grass verge then, into the started pumping from the other side. No, they had to go all up the road, turn around and come down again. So one of our sergeants, we all had a darn good laugh about it, because what he did, he cut an iron cross out of a bully beef tin and pinned it onto the fire brigade captain's lapel. There was a heck of a row. He was at him on the carpet, but nothing really came of it, because even the officer saw the funny side of it. It's so confoundedly ridiculous that they should have to harness up their horses, rush the thing up the road and back down again, whereas they wasted about a good 10 minutes, whereas it could have been done in 1 minute.
Did you have any idea that you were going to be pulled out of Russia at the end of 1919?
Oh no.
Was it sudden when your orders came through? Can you remember?
No, you see, as the winter began to close in, we came out of Ekaterinburg and made our way down towards Vladivostok. And
would you have been the last forces to have left?
Oh no.
There were others left behind you, were there?
No.
British forces?
No, others coming in.
Really?
The Americans.
Oh, did you see these yourself?
Oh yes, too true. We saw them, because we had a damn good laugh over it. When our train pulled in, and of course we'd got guns and ammunition, all that sort of thing on board in different coaches, And we used to take it in turns, two sentries on each train. That when we stopped, one would get out one side, the other chap would get out on the other, and we'd take opposite routes. Now, as this chap got down to the engine, and I got to the end of the carriage, the end of the carriages, and we'd just hand up like that, all okay, then I'd walk down his side and he'd walk up mine. Well, we stopped at a station. It was a big junction. And our officer said, all right, lads, he said, we can all go over to the station buffet and have a drink, if you like. And of course, they all trooped over, and there was only two of us left. And all of a sudden, there was this big train pulled in, and out jumped the Yanks. Well, on the engine alone, there was eight sentries. Three by the side of the engine, two in front of the engine, and three on the other side. And every carriage, right up through, had six sentries, three one side, three the other. And one of the sergeants was come walking down with it, and I spoke to him. I said, "How far are you going, Sergeant?" "Oh, don't know. We're going quite a way." I said, "Oh yeah." They said, "Where's your chap?" "Oh," I said, "they've gone with one of the officers over the rest buffet to have a drink of some kind." "Well, no," he said, "how many's in charge of your train?" "Oh," I said, "two." He said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, just two of us. Me this side, one of my mates the others. Why?" "Good God, are you telling me there's just two of you in charge of this train?" "Oh, no," I said, "we're not in charge of the train." I said, "As a matter of fact, we got a damn good crew aboard." I said, "A whole regiment, in fact, when they come back from the buffet." "So, good God," he said, and they've just left you two here in charge." "Well," I said, there's nothing in that." I said, "you got nothing to be afraid of here."
Had they just arrived in
Russia? They just arrived. But, well, we thought it was a scream, really, because, mind you, I'm not trying to make out that we were brave. Don't think that for one moment. But we hadn't experienced or felt any danger at all. Even going up, as I say, into Ekaterinburg.
Were you ever attacked by
anything
remotely like a Bolshevik?
No,